call in during that show. Thank you all for listening, and please stay tuned for Words and Pictures.
Cable Community Radio presents Evil, Cruel Thing Attacking Humanity and Controlled by the Super Rich versus You and Me. This will be an evening on ALEC, the American Legislative Exchange Council. This film and talk will take place on Thursday, November 12th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater here in Portland. Learn about how this huge, secret political entity, ALEC, creates legislation to keep wages low, to fill prisons, it bankrupts schools, and poisons the air, land, and water. Union reps, teachers, activists, journalists, and others will join moderator and KBOO news director, Jenka Soderberg, in a panel discussion on People versus ALEC. Again, that's a film and talk to learn about ALEC on Thursday, November 12th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland, and more information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Hello, and welcome to Words and Pictures, the comics and animation show. I'm your host, S.W. Conser, and in just a few minutes, I'll be joined by Ron Diamond. He's the curator of the Turing Festival Animation Show of Shows. That'll be screening at Cinema 21 all week, and Ron will be appearing in Portland at Cinema 21 tomorrow, Friday the 13th, for Q&As at all three shows. But first, the Wordstock Literary Festival is back. It's been revived by Literary Arts, and I had the pleasure of attending last weekend and meeting with author Lauren Redness. She has a new book out, and it's hard to describe. It's called Thunder and Lightning, Weather Past, Present, and Future. So, well, without any further ado, let's go out and talk with Lauren Redness. You're listening to Words and Pictures, and I'm at the Wordstock Literary Festival with author Lauren Redness. Her new book is Thunder and Lightning, Weather Past, Present, Future. Thanks for joining us on Words and Pictures.
Thank you so much for having me.
So on this show, on Words and Pictures, we've had well over 100 authors, and some of them have done graphic novels, folks like Dan Clowes and Craig Thompson. Some have done graphic memoirs, such as Ellen Forney and Alison Bechdel, and some have done graphic reportage, like Joe Sacco, Lucy Bellwood. This book, Thunder and Lightning, it just seems like an amalgam of all of these. There's scientific knowledge. You've just been all over the world to report on all of these phenomena, and yet it just has such a narrative feel to it.
Thank you. I write nonfiction books that happen to be visual books, and I report the stories, and in a certain sense, I also report to make the images, drawing on location and gathering visual reference, and then putting that together in something that isn't a graphic novel. There are no panels, there are no word balloons, so it doesn't follow the conventions of a graphic novel. But what I want it to be is an immersive experience. That's why I use the art and the writing to try to create a sensual experience that can get at the ideas that I'm trying to talk about.
Well, you studied as a painter, and so many of these images are full-page or two-page spreads, and the words go along with them. But the words themselves are a form of art because you created the typeface, Kanak LR, which is the Inuktitut word for falling snow.
Yeah, I think of the typeface as a kind of the voice of the book. So I want it to be crafted with as much care as any other aspect of the book, and in particular, because the text is woven right into the drawings themselves, I want the text to have a visual presence on the page. So I designed the typeface, and in this case, I wanted it to have a slight kind of dynamic quality, so I gave it a tilt forward as if it's being blown by the wind.
You know, every element of the book has a real hand-hewn quality to it. And you grew up
Both your parents worked very much with their hands. You learned to sew moccasins. You spent a lot of time in the woods. And every element of the book, not just the painting and not just the writing, but everything down to the actual printing was something that you worked on. Even the book binding is something that you crafted. Copperplate etching was a technique that you used to put the book together.
Yeah, I wanted to transform my drawings into etchings because I wanted to tie the images in the book to a tradition of scientific illustration. And I'm interested in the work of Audubon or Mark Catesby, the people who... Audubon was obviously an incredible master, and Mark Catesby is someone else whose work I'm really drawn to, who is more self-taught, and his work has a more primitive quality. He traveled all around the Carolinas drawing birds, and these birds that he drew have so much feeling and so much expression, and I think that what I'm drawn to in works like his, or also in works like Audubon, in botanical illustrations, is the way that the artist, in trying to convey very specific scientific information, anatomical information about an animal, or structural information about a plant, makes decisions and distortions and exaggerations in the form and in the composition that can lend a kind of strangeness and almost a surreal quality to the work. And I find that incredibly compelling. And the intensity of the observation, I just think, is thrilling. That's something that I was looking at, those types of images, as I was making these images.
So in the same vein, you seem fascinated with myth. And weather over the centuries and over the millennia has given rise to all sorts of mythological and theological systems. So while you're talking in scientific terms throughout the book, you're also bringing up the names and the stories of these figures of old nymphs and gods and forces of nature, tying this all together, and also bringing forward the stories of ordinary people in our contemporary world. Lighthouse keepers, for example, telling the stories about how fog can disorient you completely.
Yeah. Oh, this is one of my favorite chapters to work on in the book. I traveled to Newfoundland in Canada, to the easternmost point in North America. The lighthouse there is the Cape Spear Lighthouse, and the man who most recently manned that lighthouse was the sixth generation in his family to man the lighthouse there. And it actually took me 3 attempts to successfully fly to Newfoundland because every time my flight was fogged out, so I couldn't make it out of New York. But finally, when I was able to get to Newfoundland, the first day I was there, it was beautifully clear and just an absolute sublime landscape. And then the next day was white. You couldn't see anything. And all of a sudden, I really understood, you know. and so I spoke to this man, Jerry Cantwell, and he talked to me about fog and the way that it disorients you no matter how well you know a place. And so I wanted that chapter in my book to replicate that feeling of disorientation and that feeling of, as he called it, mystification. And so I removed all the text and I removed all the images, and I have page after page, which is, you know, there is maybe 6 or 7 words of text, which is quotes from my interviews with mariners who talk about their experience navigating the fog. But that's really the only point on the page where the reader is anchored, so to speak. And otherwise, you can't make out the landscape. And so I wanted the reader to be lost, to be experiencing that kind of disorientation. And I feel like that's the kind of effect that you can achieve in the fusion of words and images.
Well, in researching this book, you traveled all over the globe, to the deserts of Chile, to Saudi Arabia, to a very obscure island in the Arctic called Svalbard, where the global seed vault is kept. And this is a fascinating story. Were you expecting your visit to this very forbidding, cold island to be as interesting as it was?
You know, I didn't know what to expect, and I guess what I mean, the short answer is no, I didn't expect it to offer the kind of surprises that it did, that I was so thrilled to be able to include in the book. But that is, those kinds of serendipitous encounters are what I hope will happen with each reporting trip. And in this case, I traveled to Svalbard, to this island just south of the North Pole, to visit the Global Seed Vault, as you mentioned. And this is a place where all countries around the world send samples of indigenous species to be kept and safeguarded in case of climate change or extreme weather or war or any other local disaster that could destroy the seeds in their home countries. And this has occurred in recent years in Iraq and Afghanistan. Seed storage facilities have been destroyed. And here in Svalbard, you know, where it is so very cold and such forbidding terrain, as you say, turns out to be this kind of ideal spot for safeguarding the world's agriculture. But it also turns out to be a haven for economic migrants because of the tax laws and because of the visa laws, or lack thereof, I should say. You don't need a visa to live or work on Svalbard. So people from all over the globe make up the tiny population that is there, and people, in a way that I found parallel to the way the seeds in the vault exist in a kind of suspended animation in the cold, and the cold kind of freezes time. People leave their lives from their home countries, kind of stop time and exist in Svalbard just to earn money for usually between 6 and 8 years, and then return to their lives back home. And I met a Thai woman who is doing just this. She has a farm in a very lush river valley in Thailand, and she's gone to the Arctic to earn 5 times more what she can earn on Svalbard and send that money back home. And then she's going to go home to her pig farm and make it a more substantial place. But the one thing she said she missed while she's in Svalbard is the Thai food. She doesn't like the food you can get on Svalbard. And so her family sends her seeds. And I was just really touched by this kind of resonance between the seeds in the vault and the seeds that this woman was preserving and cooking during her time in the Arctic.
Wow. Your two previous books, your two major previous books were about Marie Curie. It's called Radioactive. And there was sort of a photonegative process that you were using that was very redolent of X-rays. And your other one was A Century Girl, 100 Years in the Life of Doris Eaton Travis, who was the last of the Ziegfeld Follies girls. And that was much brighter, had a whole lot of collage work in it. So does the subject lead the art with you, or do you want to explore something artistically and find that it leads you to a certain subject?
I think the subject leads the art, I would say. I want the medium that I use to amplify the themes of the work of the book. So in Century Girl, I had access to the archives of the woman that I was writing about, and so she gave me this incredible trove of photographs and newspaper clippings. So I use those to tell her story and to create the images in the book. And then in Radioactive, which is a story about radioactivity and love and visible forces, I use the medium of cyanotype printing, which, as you say, is a photographic medium dependent on ideas of exposure. You chemically coat paper and then you leave it in the sun, and the UV rays of the sun interact with the chemicals of the paper, and that's what creates the image. And in this book, I wanted to use etchings because of that history, of that connection with scientific illustration. So each time I make the decision based on what will best communicate the ideas of the book.
Yeah. You have a quote in Thunder and Lightning by John Ruskin about how there's no bad weather, only different forms of good weather.
Yeah. It's something that I both believe and also feel is more complicated. I mean, today we face extreme weather all over the globe. We face all of these changes unfolding because of climate change. So weather can really upend our lives, and people really can suffer in bad weather, in extreme weather, or in the various changes that we face because of climate change. So I think it's maybe a little bit glib to just accept that on its face, but at the same time, I think it does say something beautiful, which is that there are feelings and sensations and truths to be savored with every kind. I mean, it is, as you say, like, you know, we might bemoan a rainy day, but we need rainy days, and we might bemoan winter weather and needing to bundle up, but we need that too for the cycles of the plants that grow and the animals, and so we're dependent on the full spectrum of the weather that we experience. It's with the way that the patterns are shifting so rapidly with climate change that threatens to destabilize things.
So a qualified endorsement of John Ruskin. He was around before we really had to dial back on our carbon emissions.
Exactly.
You were a Guggenheim Fellow and also an artist in residence at the American Museum of Natural History. And this makes me think of how artists and scientists used to work a century or two ago. Every biological discipline, every physics class, everybody learned to draw.
Yeah.
And people who went out and studied botany, who studied animal anatomy, would learn to reproduce what they saw. Yeah. And this is something where you moved from your artistic background to your scientific background and back again. Yeah. You seem to be really advocating for a return to some of that interdisciplinary study.
Well, it's funny. I mean, at a certain point, I thought I would go get my PhD in botany. And I was working in a plant research lab at NYU. And one of the things that they had me do was plant seedlings. So I was taking Arabidopsis thaliana seedlings, which is like a mustard seed, which I guess is a very simple genome. So it's studied a lot by plant scientists. And so I would plant them in the Petri dishes in the agar and then wait for them to sprout. And then I was given the job of drawing those specimens as they, you know, those seedlings and looking for mutants. And then we would be able to study the mutants. And I found that when I was drawing those mutant specimens, I was so happy and so relieved. And so I realized that I was going to have to find a non-traditional way to incorporate science into my work. Yeah.
So should I ask you what's coming up next?
I'm not quite ready to publicly reveal. I do have a new book I'm working on in the beginning stages of reporting, but I'm trying to think of how I can summarize it, but there is a geological component, but it's not exactly a science story, but there will be geology, but it will be very different from my previous books, but in keeping, it will also be a nonfiction visual book.
Well, Lauren Redness, author of Thunder and Lightning, Weather Past, Present, and Future, thank you so much for joining us here at the Wordstock Festival for Words and Pictures.
Thank you for having me.
Yes, you're listening to Words and Pictures. I'm your host, S.W. Conser, and we're back now in the studio, and we have Ron Diamond on the phone from L.A., Ron will be coming up to Portland tomorrow, bright and early, to kick off a week-long screening of the 17th annual Animation Show of Shows. Ron's appearing tomorrow in Portland, Friday the 13th. He'll be doing Q&As at all three screenings. Ron Diamond, welcome back to Words and Pictures.
Thank you very much. Glad to be with you.
So I guess you've been racking up the airline miles. You just got in from Kansas City, and now you're going to turn around and come up to Portland.
Absolutely. Yeah, I get around. I was in Boston, I was in Atlanta and Savannah and Rochester, Philadelphia. Yeah, I get around all in the last week, if you can imagine it.
Well, now the Animation Show of Shows, I've seen this for a number of years. I work in animation, so this has been a little bit of a secret for the general public, and you've been working on making this year's festival much more of a widely available event for people, and you had a successful Kickstarter that's really getting a lot of play that's really getting the word out.
Well, the Kickstarter afforded me some momentum to actually get this thing rolling. I mean, I've been presenting the show of shows 16 years prior to this. And it was only for private screenings, studios, and at schools, leading animation departments. It was easy. It was simple. There were no contracts. It was all very, very pleasant and not very complicated on a business front, but there was no economics to it. And I've reached a very solid point of penetration in regards to the animation industry in the United States and in Canada. People recognize the show of shows, and they respect it, and they enjoy it. They find it a great forum to discover new work. But eventually I realized I want people to discover the films, the real people, the people out on the street. I want them to become literate and aware of the great work that's sort of being created by artists around the globe.
Well, the animation show shifts, I remember that years ago, selling DVDs was a big part of it, and it's harder and harder with streaming content now to do that. But this year, as in all previous years, you have a whole bunch of content from around the world. It's not just one style or one country. You have a huge range of techniques and styles, and a huge range of filmmakers, including Don Hertzfeld, who's been a friend of the show. His new short film is going to be out there. It's gotten rave reviews.
Well, we do. We have films. We have films from Switzerland, France, Great Britain, from Ireland, from the U.S., and then even from Russia, and our very first short film from Iran. And we begin to get an understanding as to what different artists, storytellers are thinking, what kind of profound ideas they're dealing with, and the artistry that they're bringing to their productions. Sometimes it's obvious that the films come from their countries, and sometimes not.
And like with non-animated film festivals, what you find is that there's a whole lot of relatability. There's a whole lot of instances where we're really telling the same story, the same human story.
Well, you know, there's a universal truth to so many of these stories. Most of the films have no dialogue. They're told in pantomime, not acted out in any kind of unexpected way. I mean, you follow the story, you enjoy it. You don't even want for the words to be spoken. You just sit and observe the characters going about their business, and you discover a beautiful universe that the filmmaker creates. And remarkably, you feel a great sense of emotion, both exhilarating humor and a deep emotional sadness at points during some of the films. You really begin to understand more about how to tell a story that you don't really need words. And then, again, some of these stories are universal. So, for instance, We Can't Live Without Cosmos. It's a short film by a Russian animator, Konstantin Bronzid, who was nominated for the Oscar for his short film, Lavatory Love Story, about 5 years ago. This is his new film, and not one word is spoken, just like with Lavatory Love Story. And in the, I believe, 13 minutes, you know, we have two characters who endear us, and we come to like them a lot, and we care about them, and something happens, and it's not quite what we expect. And it's a lot for them and for us to deal with.
Yeah, there's it's amazing how quickly we can laugh and be overcome with wonder and then have our heart broken. But the strength of animation really is that the artist has so much power to exaggerate the rules of the world, the physics of the world, and to put all of this information in the frame that a live action filmmaker would have a lot of trouble doing. Like you said, wordless, so many animated shorts are wordless, and it really goes back to the strength that silent film had back in the early days of film, where it could cross cultures and really affect people regardless of language or borders.
You've just hit it right on the head with the with the reference to silent films. I mean, here we actually follow the characters, we identify with them, we're pulled right in. I mean, it's incredible what we begin to feel when we're watching these films. And, the great thing is that they're appropriate for all ages. So, I've seen six-year-olds come to see the program with their parents, and they still get a lot out of it. And I'll tell you, there's a lot to talk about afterwards. There's a lot of different subjects with 11 different short films.
Now, you're a big believer in traveling around to different festivals and meeting new up-and-coming artists as well as really established artists. You've certainly been to the great animation festivals like Ottawa and Hiroshima and Annecy in France. And So, you know, this is this festival here that you're bringing in. You seem to be wanting to take that spirit, take that that whole range of what's available, and kind of present it. Is that going to be kind of the future of the animation show and shows to sort of distill the best of what's out there all around the world for local audiences?
Well, I think consistently it has been to distill films down. The films that I would normally show to studios might be a little bit stronger in terms of exploring perhaps a technique or style of storytelling, and therefore it may not be perfect in every way, but in regards to the shows for the public, it's really geared toward more of a family audience, and yeah, the same kind of ideology in terms of putting together the best of the best and pieces that anybody can sit and watch and really get into is very, very important to me. This year's different, though I will say that because of the Kickstarter campaign, we have produced 4 documentaries. They're short. They're very short. They're under 3 minutes. And they follow each of the films about the filmmakers whose films we've just seen. And it gives us a little bit of insight into what their motivation is, a little bit about who they are, and very importantly, is why they chose to make that particular film. Because each film is an extension of the individual. There's something about that person in their life that causes them to want to make these narratives, and very specifically, these narratives. And so we come to meet, you know, Connor Whelan from Dublin and Constantine Bronzett from St. Petersburg and Melissa Johnson and Robertino Zambrano. Melissa's, we shot hers here in Los Angeles and got a little bit of Robertino. He's in Australia. And lastly, we have one shot with Babak and Banood Nakui in Tehran. And we have a very different perception of Tehran when we see these two filmmakers working in their studio with their artists and walking through the streets of Tehran. It's a completely different universe. It's as if they were in San Francisco, New York, or Paris. They're regular guys, but except they're passionate about animation. And it's marvelous to be able to see that.
That sounds like it'll be a real eye-opener, yes. Well, you know, one of our local animation directors here, Joan Gratz, has actually taught in Tehran. So yeah, maybe one day we'll be a lot more open with folks that we've been closed off to in the past.
Well, I think film festivals in general try to bridge those gaps. I know, you know, I've been going to festivals for 35 years, and you know, I try to go to festivals that are not your ordinary festival. So earlier this year, I was in Poland, in Poznan, Poland, for an animation festival. Last year, I was all the way out in the Republic of Georgia, in Nicosi, which is literally right on the border of the Russian border. And I was advised by the American ambassador there, who came to visit me 3 times. He drove an hour each time to see me, and he assured me I was a great patriot for bringing art and culture to the people in Georgia. And he pointed off in what appeared to me to be the distance, and he says, "Don't go over there." I said, "Why not?" And he says, "Well, you might not be able to see it, but there are tanks pointed in this direction." I said, "Really?" And he says, "Yeah, the Russian tanks, because, you know, there's a problem here. I mean, they were in battle in 2008, which is fairly recently." And so then he clarified for me that it was only 100 yards away that I shouldn't walk. I mean, it was
only
very serious stuff.
Right.
Very serious. He said, "If you walk in that direction, you go 101 yards, you're not coming back. You entered Russia the wrong way." So, and ironically, we had Russians, marvelously talented filmmakers, there at the festival in Nicosi. So, you know, I do try. You know, I've been to China and India and meeting with animators all over the globe, looking for new talent and discovering great short films at the same time.
Wow. Well, we'll look forward to hearing more of your stories tomorrow, Friday the 13th, at Cinema 21 in Portland. You're going to be at 3 shows, 4:30, 6:45, and 9 o'clock. Ron Diamond, how can we find out more about the Animation Show of Shows and your other projects, Acme Filmworks and all of that?
Well, let's see. You can certainly find out about Acme Filmworks by visiting acmefilmworks.com. You can discover lots of information, including how to donate and participate in our new 501c3, the Animation Show of Shows, at animationshowshows.com. And as a matter of fact, people who are interested in animation and love great animation and discover the show and want to have it, I'll be bringing lots of DVDs with me. I still continue to produce DVDs because I believe it's an important medium to offer films.
That's right. When your streaming goes down, you have a DVD you can play.
You can count on it. And there's just so much more material. If we think about how it used to be when VHS was around, and when we lost VHS, we lost lots of movies that we can't get on DVD. And DVD comes around, and then Blu-ray shows up, and we lose a lot of movies that we can't get on Blu-ray. And now with both of those going away, all we're going to have is places like Netflix and things like that, which, of course, do a phenomenal job. But there are so many great films out there. We need to have a lot of diversity in our entertainment.
Well, you've been listening to Words and Pictures. Our guest today has been Ron Diamond, curator of the Animation Show of Shows. Ron, thank you for joining us today on KABU.
It's a real pleasure, Conch. I look forward to meeting everybody in Portland. And by the way, I'll be in Eugene at the Metro, Bijou Metro, on Saturday for all the screenings there as well.
Fantastic. Thanks also to Lauren Redness, our author of Thunder and Lightning at the Wordstock Literary Festival. And thanks to all our listeners on the radio dial and at KBOO.FM. You can find an archived version of this show later today at KBOO.FM/wordsandpictures. And be sure to follow us on Twitter at wordsandpicture. Now stay tuned for an afternoon of music on your homegrown Portland radio station.
And now the KBOO News at Noon for Thursday, November 12th, 2015. I'm John Schock. Oracle America is filing a new lawsuit today in Marion County Circuit Court against Governor Kate Brown. According to Willamette Week, Oracle contends that Governor Brown's office failed to comply with Oregon public records law.